Hello and welcome to today's episode of Medical Ethics Unpacked. I'm Dr. Steve Levine, and I'm joined by my esteemed co-host, Dr. Dominic Sisti, as well as a special guest, Johan Dahlgren. Today, we'll be discussing an exciting and controversial class of medications, the GLP-1s. Certainly, most of our listeners are familiar with GLP-1s, and in fact, most of the world at this point, as drugs like Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, have become household names. These are intriguing drugs with potentially wide-ranging benefits for a number of health conditions, particularly their labeled indications of diabetes and obesity, where they've had life-changing impact. But these drugs aren't free, and there isn't an unlimited supply. In fact, up until very recently, there was a global shortage. So that raises important ethical questions about who should receive them and who should pay. Dr. Dahlgren recently co-authored an important paper proposing a fair allocation framework for GLP-1s and related compounds, and I look forward to being a fly on the wall as my two colleagues here, who are smarter and better qualified than I am, discuss this. Dom?
Thanks, Steve. It's great to have you, Johan. Johan is a research fellow at the University of Pennsylvania in the Department of Medical Ethics and Health Policy, my home department. And he works with Dr. Zeke Emanuel in Zeke's lab. Johan's been a co-author on several papers with Zeke and others on distributive justice and GLP-1 agonists. And so we're really delighted and privileged to have you today, Johan. And I guess we'll just get right into it. And I'm going to ask you to kind of start us off with just a basic overview of the GLP-1 agonist sort of landscape, where we are in terms of policy, what's covered by Medicare, Medicaid, private insurers, et cetera, and how did we get into a situation where there is scarcity? And also just kind of thinking about what in fact is scarce. Is it the compound itself? Is it the delivery device? Those sorts of questions will start us off and kind of level set. So, over to you, Don.
Great. Thanks. Thanks for having me on. I'm glad to be here. I should clarify, I'm not a doctor yet. I'm doing a pre-doctoral fellowship right now, but it'll happen eventually. So I appreciate that's aspirational. Well, GLP drugs have been around for a little while, actually. The first drug entered the U.S. market in 2014. It was liraglutide, which is a diabetes medication. Semaglutide came out shortly after that, but only in its formulation for diabetes. Researchers knew that it could have wider impacts than that. The hormone that it mimics in the body impacts feelings of fullness, impacts gastric emptying, in addition to having impacts on blood glucose and blood glucose management. So, For a long time, it's been known that these types of drugs might have an impact on obesity, but it wasn't until much later, almost close to 2020, that drugs were widely available in the GLP-1 category for obesity. Obviously, Wegovy was the first one, quickly followed by Zepbound, which is the tirzepatide formulation from Lilly. The landscape, I wish that I had better data to report, but it is, as far as insurance coverage, as far as what is in shortage, which medications, or if it's the devices that deliver them, it varies by country, it varies by state, it varies by pharmacy, and obviously it varies by who your insurance coverer is. Coverage is, it really runs the gamut of some insurance companies are investing in these drugs as preventative care because it looks like they could prevent major adverse cardiovascular events, could prevent some of the complications that come with having obesity for a long time. And some are horrified by the price tag, which can be upwards of $1,300 a month for some of the obesity formulations, and therefore aren't covering them at all. And though that might seem short-sighted, health plan funds are scarce, and health plan executives and those who decide what ends up on a formulary are stewards of shared funds. And even though it's probably my personal opinion that these drugs are extraordinarily effective and should be covered, at least for some people, you have to understand that because these health plan dollars are limited, not everything can be covered.
Right. And that kind of brings us to the theme of the show, which is distributive justice and how we decide what gets covered for whom and when, and for what reasons. So you write a great paper with Zeke and I think Govind Prasad and Matt McCoy, and a few other great papers. But the one I want to zero in on was in the New England Journal of Medicine just a few months ago, and there'll be a link to that paper on HCP Live. I'd just love for you to kind of unpack for us the values that you and your colleagues articulate as the guiding values for equitable distribution of GLP-1 agonists.
Yeah, absolutely. Now, I can't really take credit for the development of this general framework. It's mostly my colleagues and advisors, really, Govind and Zeke, that have spent a long time in a lot of their careers developing what is called the fair priority model. The basis of having, so it's a multi-principle model, which means that it's not distribution based off of one principle, it's distribution based off of a compromise of many principles. And I think it's important to start there. The reason is, when you're allocating a scarce resource, you're allocating it to people who have different conceptions of what good is. They have different notions of what is right and what is wrong. And if you're only allocating based on one value, some people who are subject to the allocation that that decides whether they get their medication or not might find the system illegitimate. They might disagree with it in such a way that in itself is unjust. And so having a multi-principled system that kind of balances different types of ethical frameworks, ethical viewpoints, is supposed to have broader appeal and then broader legitimacy to the people whose lives are truly impacted. So the first value that we start with is probably one that makes the most sense. It's probably the one that we would all think of first, which is benefiting people and preventing harm. This is based in a really general way, based in utilitarian ethics, which is the idea that there are different states, and some states are better than others. Like status quo, not like states like Colorado.
States of affairs.
Thanks, Tom. There are different states of affairs, and some of them are preferable. And what we should focus on is comparing those states of affairs and trying to find the one with the most good, which could be defined as happiness or utility or health. In this type of allocation, it would be either years of life or lives saved. Probably a more pure utilitarian would say lives saved. But that can't in itself be the only factor on which you determine who can receive a scarce resource, because there are lots of ways that can go wrong. If you're purely utilitarian, if you're only focusing on benefiting people, you could concentrate the benefit on just a few people, or you could systemically deny coverage to other people and still end up in a state of affairs where there's a lot of utility. And because we care about the distribution, not just the amount of utility or the number of lives saved, there have to be other values. So one of those is equal moral concern, which recognizes the equal moral importance of each person, irrespective of factors such as race, sex, religion, or income. Income is a little bit more controversial than the others, but I imagine that nobody would really disagree that it's important that we afford equal moral concern to everybody to whom an application scheme applies. This is probably based more in deontology or Kantian philosophy, which is more of a rights-based system about constraints on the way that we are able to treat other people while acting morally. It's also an incredibly important value to remember, because health plans or governments or whoever is allocating they have an equal duty to each of their plan members. Then a third point is prioritizing disadvantaged people. That's a third value, and it means prioritizing people that would be worst off without the intervention, or who otherwise would be at risk of having a short life or suffering severe illness. This, in a sense, arises from a Rawlsian approach to distributive justice. In particular, something in the theory of justice, Rawls's probably most influential work, called the difference principle. And I wrote down one formulation of the difference principle because I didn't want to mess it up. Differences or inequalities in the allocation of goods are acceptable only if they benefit the worst off, which is kind of confusing to think about. I think that it maybe could be illustrated by thinking of like an agrarian society, or just like a small, simple society where the allocation of important social goods or important resources should be fairly simple to imagine. And you could think that it would be unfair to allow some people to have more resources than other people. But Rawls is saying that if you incentivize innovation or productivity or usefulness to society in a way that benefits the people who are worst off, then that inequality in distribution is okay. So if somebody were to invent a farming technique or something that made food more widely available or made food cheaper, even for those who are worst off in a society, the least money had the least food, then Rawls would say it's okay to reward that person, or to generally as a society to incentivize that behavior. And then the fourth value that we have in the fair priority model is rewarding social contribution. It's a little bit less applicable to this instance, but I think an example that we can all remember is during the COVID pandemic when healthcare workers were able to get vaccinations before other people. I suppose it's almost in some respects a pragmatic value in that we want those who are going to be able to help ameliorate the situation or provide life-saving care to be safe themselves.
Right, right. And in a way, it's a recognition of their contribution. I mean, it's not just going back to the COVID model, which is, and I should also back up and say Govind and Zeke developed this model around a pandemic, right? Possibility way back. Bird flu, I think, was the model, but the vaccine allocation framework is essentially what we're talking about here. But like in that, for this particular value, you know, in the vaccine context, you'll have healthcare workers, maybe even like funeral directors who would probably get the vaccine first because of social need, right? To keep those folks safe. With the in the context of GLP-1s, I guess because, you know, you might say that you want to keep like endocrinologists healthy or people that are actually distributing the drugs, but it's such a long-term, you know, proposition. It's not really super relevant for this particular case. That was
hopefully as vaccines may now be a moot point.
Yeah, right. I guess we'll.
Well, and that's something to think about. That's something to think about maybe later in the episode with the availability and coverage of GLP-1s. There are dissenting viewpoints in the new administration. But I suppose should I move on to the second table of the paper, which is the application of these principles.
Well, yeah. Let's just let's take a minute here and just. Let's stop for a second here and just take stock of the indications we're going to be talking about. So we've got GLP-1s for diabetes. We've got them for obesity, right? And are any of these approved for preventative cardiovascular events and things like that?
They are. The Wegovy is approved for preventing major adverse cardiovascular events in certain populations. However, at the time we were initially writing this paper, it wasn't yet. And so that's not included in our framework, although that would be a really interesting complication to see how that would kind of augment or change the priority status.
Okay, gotcha. So yeah, let's unpack the values and go through the different tiers that you and Zeke and Govin and Matt developed. And I guess start us off by just talking about why you're going to prioritize obesity over diabetes.
Yeah. Well, I think we should start with this idea, PYLL, or potential years of life lost, which is how we chose to operationalize these values. So we have values and we have all sorts of justifications and we have different ideas of how to realize the values. And we're using potential years of life lost to realize the values of the FAIR priority model. And a potential year of life lost, it's kind of a confusing metric, but it takes a population benchmark, how long an average person would live in a certain society. So we can say that's maybe 80 years. And then it takes an individual person's condition and projects how much of their life could be lost due to that, whatever condition they have. The ones we're looking at are diabetes and obesity. And that delta, the difference between how long they might live and the population average, which is very wide. It's not related to a person's race or income or anything. It's just a single number that we use. That delta is the potential years of life lost. And so we want to minimize the potential years of life lost. And though it seems like it might only be appealing to the first value of benefiting people and preventing harm, it actually also affords everyone equal moral concern and prioritizes disadvantaged people. It affords everyone equal moral concern because we use a single standard, regardless of a person's other influential elements of their health identity. It's not influenced by their income or their race or whatever. And it does prioritize disadvantaged people because it promotes those, pushes them to the top of the allocation scheme, puts them in the top tier, who are more likely to lose the most years of life. And those people are really fundamentally disadvantaged. It's a profound disadvantage to die early. Our years of life are one of the most important resources that we have. So that is the disadvantage that we're recognizing and trying to lessen.
So in a way, you're pegging this to an average, but it's almost like it's the life expectancy of people who are pretty well off to offset some of the socioeconomic, maybe race-based disadvantages that individuals might have in terms of their life course.
Back to that. That's exactly right.
Yeah, we'll get back to that point when we talk about some objections. Okay.
Yeah.
Just a quick question also. So with the potential years of life lost, of course, the metric there is length. It's the length of life. I suppose you might have chosen something like quality of life or functional status. Am I right in assuming that the choice of length of life is because that is data that's always available, whereas quality of life for functional status may not be captured or may not be available?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's really hard to measure quality of life as well. Disability adjusted life years or quality of life adjusted life years are, that itself is an incredibly fraught area of bioethics. And rightfully so, because I think it's really difficult to determine the quality of somebody else's experience when it's something that's inherently incomprehensible to other people. So this felt like more of a clinical metric that would hold an equal standard to everybody and wouldn't necessarily impose our notions of what is a quality life and what isn't. However, all of these metrics have drawbacks. All of them are a bit confusing. None of them is perfect yet. And something that's interesting about the metric we chose to use is that when people exceed their expected life years, if you're thinking about allocation to somebody who's 85 years old, when the population average that we use is 80, they aren't counted. So that would be a drawback, perhaps.
And so based on the PYLL, We find individuals with serious obesity and diabetes in tier one, right?
Yeah, that's exactly right. The common sentiment at the time, and I think perhaps for some, the sentiment that still remains, is that we should be prioritizing people with diabetes rather than people with obesity. I think that comes from a view that people commonly hold, that obesity is a lifestyle condition, that people simply need to change what they eat or their exercise habits, and also from a lack of knowledge about the serious health consequences of having obesity over a long period of time. We found some really interesting studies about, particularly in men, but for people of all genders, if you have obesity if you become obese at, say, 20 years old and continue to be obese for the remainder of your life, it can cut as much as 10, 12, or 15 years off of one's expected lifespan, which, again, would be a profound disadvantage. And because of, honestly, because we were just aghast at that number, and that number has been replicated in lots of different studies and analyses, we decided to promote people with obesity. There are other reasons that we included people with obesity in the top tiers. One is that there are a lot of alternative medications that are effective for treating diabetes. In addition to like first-line treatments like metformin, there's also other more experimental treatments, some of which even interfere with the same types of systems that GLP-1 receptor agonists that work in a similar way. Some are called SGLT2 inhibitors, which have been found to be just as effective as GLP-1 receptor agonists in people with type 2 diabetes, which is the population that GLP-1 RAs would be treating. And for obesity, there just aren't alternative medications that have proven as effective. There are a few FDA-approved medications. There are a few formerly FDA-approved medications as well, many of which were dangerous and all of which were ineffective. The percent body weight loss of some of those, it never surpassed 10% and was more often in the 4 to 6% body weight loss area as compared to the GLP-1s, which are achieving 20% or sometimes even more than 20% weight loss. So that's really clinically significant.
Johan, the SGLT-2s, I guess, those are effective in treating diabetes. Do they also help with weight loss?
They have been shown to reduce weight somewhat, but that is it's not as much of a loss in weight that's normally seen in people with diabetes who are on SGLT2s. Which might be a reason that some people with diabetes who are looking for a treatment would prefer a GLP-1 RA, because it could also aid with weight loss. However, we think that people who are more severely affected by obesity should probably have priority over those who could be treated for something else, with something else for their diabetes, and also are just looking for the positive externality of a little bit of weight loss.
Gotcha. Okay.
A third reason that we thought to include people with obesity in the higher tiers and in a sense prioritize people with obesity is because it will prevent the development of type 2 diabetes, and it will prevent the development of other comorbidities that will be costly and that will be deadly.
In terms of just allocation and who's the worst off here, I mean, what's the epidemiology tell us about obesity and diabetes? I mean, they map against socioeconomic status, race, all these things. If you had to like put them side, match them up, which is more highly associated with issues with privilege and socioeconomic status?
That's a great question. I mean, they both are. They both absolutely are the result of systemic impediments to people living healthy lifestyles, or having access to healthy food, or having time to cook themselves healthy meals. We all know this. I think type 2 diabetes, perhaps more so, is related to race. It's more prevalent in communities of color, although both diseases are disproportionately common in communities of color. I don't think that it makes a significant difference.
Gotcha. Mm-hmm. Okay. So we've got then on the top tier, severe. Go ahead.
Yeah. In the top tier, it's people with the most severe obesity, which we chose to measure with a metric of body mass index, which we know is flawed and also fraught. And some people think that there should be a better metric for measuring obesity at a population level. And I think we agree with that. There should be a better metric because it is flawed, but it's the best metric that we have right now that doesn't require like complicated or expensive body scans, which would kind of throw a wrench into the whole system. And so that's what we chose to use. And we also chose to prioritize younger people. In each of the tiers, we have a phase one and a phase two. So in tier one, we would be treating people with the most severe obesity and people who have type 2 diabetes who haven't responded to alternative treatments but have tried alternative treatments like SGLT2 inhibitors. And then we begin with younger patients and then follow with older patients. And the reason that we're doing that is to maximize the potential years of life that we can save, or the averted potential years of life lost. So you'll notice that in every tier, we first have a phase of those approximately 50 years and younger, followed by a phase of those who are older than that. And then as the tiers go down, it's people with less severe obesity, which we categorize as class 2 obesity, and then people with severe uncontrolled type 2 diabetes, but not necessarily those that have tried other treatments like SGLT2 inhibitors. In the third tier, it would be people with class 1 obesity, and then it would go eventually to people just with overweight.
Okay. So essentially, the state of affairs that we have at the moment is, as I look out and see people taking Wegovy for weight loss and they don't have diabetes, we have a pretty unjust distribution set up right now. It's sort of random, right? I mean, it's almost like whoever can get their hands on the medication.
Yeah. Well, it is partially random, but it's also deeply informed by income. The people who have the most money are able to pay out of pocket for these, and so as long as they get a prescription, they're usually more likely to be able to secure this medication. And so we've the New York Times has done some really excellent reporting on areas with the highest income levels. Zip codes with the highest income levels also have the highest rates of Wegovy or Zepbound use, but some of the lowest rates of obesity. So it seems to really just be going to those that are able to spend $1,300 a month on some cosmetic, mostly cosmetic weight loss.
Or folks who have pretty good insurance. So like I, for example, I take Wegovy, it's covered by my insurance. It's $25 a month. So it's, you know, I couldn't afford it out of pocket. So there are, I think, you know, cases where there's just disproportionate advantage based on your insurance provider. And I think that's in my case is the, you know, example. I don't have diabetes, but I do have CV risks and I do have obesity. So, I guess I would fall in the, I don't know, slot number 4 still, but, or maybe slot 3, I don't know. But in any case, the sort of patchwork of coverage and distribution and access, really seems like a serious problem given the game-changing properties of these medications. And this is a great framework to start us off. Now, how might we implement something like this?
Well, that's a great question. And I think if you know really anything about the American healthcare system, you would know that we probably can't and we probably won't.
At the state level, though, Johan, maybe, or at a more local. I mean, I get that we've just got, you know, this massive country with various laws and states have different, you know, insurance laws and things. Could we implement it at like a state level, maybe?
It probably could be implemented in some sense at a state level if they're the government is able to have recommendations or even requirements about what insurance has to cover or what types of conditions insurance has to provide treatment for. At least as of now, I find it unlikely. I think the
are you referring? Biggest, sorry, you're referring to the CMS six protected classes.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Or in the passage of the ACA, there were a few conditions, or there were a few rules about what has to be covered by insurance and what can't be. That might be what you're referring to.
Yeah.
As well. The obviously public programs. It would be easier to introduce an allocation framework for public, like Medicare and Medicaid, because the government is the insurer, or the government at least has more of a stake in insurance because they're paying for it. So even if they're not directly administering it, like with Medicare Advantage, they're still paying for it. And so it would be easier to introduce an allocation scheme. But really, I think it would be an extremely difficult thing to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think that's true. I think the principles you've laid out, though, are coherent. And to the extent that we can apply them, I think we should. I'm just looking at the clock here. I don't want to spend too much more time on the nuts and bolts of the framework, but I'd be really curious to hear about how you would respond to a couple of objections, Johan. So I was looking through the New England Journal and saw a couple of letters, one of which took exception with the notion that the PYLL is colorblind or race blind. And I thought your response was really interesting in distinguishing between sort of racism conscious interventions and race conscious interventions. And I'd love to hear your thoughts on or just explain that distinction and respond to that objection.
Yeah. So some people wrote a letter and submitted it to the New England Journal of Medicine. And it was a really thoughtful letter that I thought raised important issues, which is that we don't explicitly identify groups of people, whether that be groups identified by race or income or geography or what have you, that that should be prioritized simply because of that identifying demographic trait. But we do, in fact, our framework is racism conscious rather than race-based. And so if we were to propose a framework in which like certain minority populations have an explicit higher tier or will receive a scarce medication first, that would be race-based. And there are a few drawbacks to that. But rather than that, we chose to do a racism conscious policy. And it's racism conscious because we recognize that people in Black and Brown communities are disproportionately affected by both type 2 diabetes and by obesity. And so by calculating potential years of life lost, it's more likely that the people who have large potential years of life lost will be from those communities. They will be implicitly rather than explicitly promoted. And it's promotion that's rather than being based exclusively on their race is based on medical necessity. And so racism conscious framework is, in addition to being more legally palatable and also perhaps having the illusion of fair, not even an illusion, being more fair and more acceptable to people, it addresses the downstream manifestations of race, would be how people would think about it.
Yes. Okay. That seems right. I mean, as we discussed earlier, I mean, the pegging of the kind of average lifespan kind of builds in some of those considerations, because you're talking about 80 years old is probably 10 years longer than people who are Black or Brown that have low socioeconomic status. So that almost adds like 10 years to the score, right? That would advantage, that would set them up for a higher tier. That makes a lot of sense. I guess that objection was more about, the idea that the PYLL metric is somewhat of a blunt instrument and they're asking you to be a little bit more precise, maybe. But then, there's that trade-off between precision and fairness, right? So I think, you know, yeah.
Yeah. There's also a trade-off between precision and like plausibility or logistical success,
right,
which is that it would be really difficult to trace down or make sure that people's self-identified race is legitimate or that's not really our place.
Right.
And so to have that have undue impact would be unfair.
Yes. That makes sense. The other thing I was thinking about is adherence to these drugs and whether somebody should get booted off their tier if they're not adherent and using the drugs properly and responsibly. Curious what your thoughts are.
Glad you raised that, Dom, because that was on my mind as well. All right, although granted, you know, many of our medications just aren't effective for some people and all of them, are imperfect in some way. The number one reason why somebody won't benefit from any treatment is because they're not actually adherent to it. They never filled a prescription in the first place. They filled it, but they take it inconsistently or not consistent with guidelines or instructions. They take it inconsistently. They don't take it at all, et cetera. Or they don't make other modifications to diet, lifestyle, et cetera, that, that help the drug be most effective and may also be part of the treatment plan. So, yeah, I was curious about the absence of those kind of patient level considerations of adherence and otherwise as part of the framework.
Yeah, that's a really great point. And something I think we could have done a better job of explicitly addressing. One thing that we were thinking about and is kind of almost like a coda to the paper, but it's just the last few paragraphs, is that even if we were to implement some kind of allocation structure today or when this paper was published, there are already people who have been on these medications for a long time. And we can learn about patients and their behaviors and the likelihood of adherence from a demonstrated history of adherence. And so we proposed that there be some consideration or priority of people who are already taking these drugs, regardless of the tier structure, because if you've been taking it for 12 months and it's been doing what it's supposed to be doing, you've been able to tolerate the side effects, whatever insurance you have or whatever financial support you have has been facilitating your ability to get the drug, well, then you're benefiting from it. And those benefits are important. So we did think about that, especially as adherence rates are fairly low for these drugs. That's still yet to be identified exactly why that's the case, whether it's side effects, whether it's cost, whether it's availability or other facets of access. But yeah, some of those patient level identifiers are really important. There's also just looking outside of the U.S. for a second, we had another paper that looked at policies from other countries, especially countries with national healthcare systems or just better regulation of their healthcare sphere. And Iceland, for example, has their national insurance will cover GLP-1 receptor agonists for obesity, but they have certain rules, and one of those rules is that you demonstrate weight loss at certain thresholds. And so within 6 months, you're supposed to have lost 5% of your body weight. And within 12 months, you'll have to lose 10 or 15% of your body weight. There's some threshold, which not only monitors adherence and make sure that the government is paying for medication that's being used, but it also measures it at an individual level, at a patient level, how successful these are. And so if it's not the right medication for someone, the government won't be wasting its money. The health plan won't be wasting its money on it.
So given the enormous benefits of these medicines and the scarcity that we are experiencing at the moment, I guess I have two questions. One is, wouldn't it be an ethical argument to just sort of put a pause on the patent and allow for compounders and generics to come out to fill the gap that is causing the scarcity? And I feel like there's an ethical almost obligation based on everything we're talking about here to allow that. And then two, I guess my question would be, is this framework going to be relevant in 10 years? This is reflecting another letter that you guys received. Will there be a shortage? I mean, it seems like there's going to be so many new variations. They're gonna, Novo Nordisk will ramp up manufacturing. Lilly will ramp up. I mean, is there going to be a shortage in 5-10 years when, you know, the benefits that you guys predict would be accrued?
Well, those are both great questions. First, yes, I think there is clearly an ethical obligation or an ethical imperative to pause patents or to shorten the length of patents or to allow exceptions so that more people would be able to access this life-saving drug. I think people who disagree with that sentiment, and there are a lot of people, and some of them have legitimate reasons. What they might say is that pharmaceutical companies should, we should incentivize pharmaceutical companies to create drugs that deliver value, drugs that are effective at treating what it is they're supposed to treat. And these drug companies have done just that. They've created really effective drugs, drugs that can treat obesity like no drugs have ever before, and drugs that have so many possible applications that it's really exciting. This is an incredible discovery. And if we have systems in place, especially financial systems that incentivize drug companies to continue creating and manufacturing drugs like this, it's probably more likely that we'll have more medical breakthroughs. And so if we were to pause patent protections, companies like Eli Lilly and Novo Nordisk that have done really incredible work might be less likely in the future to invest in that R&D or to offer those drugs on our markets. Now, I don't think that either of those companies could really make any argument or arouse any sympathy, at least probably with this group, that they haven't made enough money, because they've made billions and billions of dollars from these drugs. But it is a hard balance. It's a hard balance to draw, and somebody much, much smarter than me should be the one to answer those questions. On the question of timeline, that was also an interesting letter that we received. Yes, there will be a lot of drugs in the future in this class, and they won't be scarce forever. But I think the notion that we should base our strategy today based on what may or may not happen in the future is faulty and fallacious for a few reasons. One is that we don't know what will happen in the future. And another kind of more principled response to that is that it kind of implies that maximizing benefit is the only is the sole value that we should base our distribution off of. But that would seem to me to ignore the less outcome-driven values that are inherent in our fair priority model framework, mm-hmm. Which would be the ones of equal moral concern and prioritizing the disadvantaged. And though if we know for certain that there will be much wider availability and that the prices will come down, we might there might be some reason to think about allowing older people, for example, to have more access to these drugs, because younger people will be able to have access soon. And it's like a slow accumulation of suffering from diabetes or having overweight for years and years that would cause some of the more dangerous comorbidities or death or disease or whatever. But that would seem to ignore the fact that those who are young are already profoundly disadvantaged just by the threat of living shorter lives than those who perhaps despite their disease have lived a long life. And so I think out of respect for the multiplicity of values that we hold and that the population holds, that would be short-sighted in a way.
Yeah, that's helpful. And that makes total sense, Johan. I have one more question for you, Johan. Steve, do you have anything you want to ask?
Please go ahead, Dom.
Yeah, so my final question, I guess, I have many more, but this will wrap up, is around the potential for these drugs to treat conditions other than obesity, diabetes, like thinking here about addiction, potentially Alzheimer's-related dementias, and other potential things like chronic pain, for example. And I'm wondering if as data come in about these other conditions, should folks who maybe have genetic predispositions or have those conditions those should those be added kind of to their score to kind of bump them up in the tiers? Imagine somebody with just who has obesity, no diabetes, but maybe also has opioid addiction issues or a history thereof, and we're starting to see these medications help with addiction. So I'd be curious how preventative potential interacts with the current framework.
That's a wonderful question, and one that I think is impossible to answer in a lot of ways. I suppose if you, yes, there's legitimate reason to think about including people who have genetic predispositions for addiction or opioid use disorder, or alcoholism or something, to include that. And I suppose if that were my task, I would think again in terms of potential years of life lost, about what is the likelihood of developing opioid use disorder, for example, and what is the expected life shortening effect of that, and then perhaps including that. I think as of right now, at least, because a lot of this research, though very exciting, is not at the level that the FDA has like approved it for these indications, or that we are certain that that it can prevent or treat all of these things that it could potentially prevent or treat. When it's just speculation, perhaps speculation that's supported by some really exciting data, but still, in a certain sense, it's speculation. I think that probably shouldn't have an impact on who's accessing these drugs today.
Yeah. That's great. Thank you for that response. It makes sense. Johan, this has been wonderful. I'm just looking at the time here and we're up on the hour. So unless Steve, you have anything?
No, this has been great. Really wonderful discussion. Thank you so much as always, Dom, for lending your expertise as a bioethicist and an all around smart and interesting guy. And to Johan for being a great guest and an expert on this subject. Really, a fascinating discussion. There, for better or for worse, are probably an unlimited number of topics of ethical interest within the healthcare system today. So Dom and I will keep talking about it in future episodes. We hope that you continue to tune in on HCP Live, as well as wherever you receive your podcasts, such as Apple Music and Spotify, and really appreciate this group's conversation today and your listening.
Thank you so much, Johan, and we'll see everybody again in about a month.